Center Church community, very happy to be with you today as we are very rapidly approaching the end of Ecclesiastes. We are wrapping up chapter 10 and heading toward the final two chapters of the text. So today we're going to be talking about chaos and order within the government, timely, and chaos and order within our own household. And then finally, we'll talk about what is the wise, Christ-centered response to the chaos and order we see at the governmental level and the chaos and order we desire, the order anyway, that we desire for our own household. So here is chapter 10, verse 16. And again, this is Alter's translation, by the way. Woe to you, land, whose king is a lackey. Many translations read, whose king is a child. And your princes dine in the morning. Happy are you, land, whose king is a noble, and your princes dine in fit time, in manliness, not in drunkenness. Through sloth the roof beam sags, and through slack hands the house leaks. For food is set out for merriment, and wine that gladdens the living. And money keeps everyone busy. Even on your couch revile not a king, and in your sleeping chambers revile not a rich man, for the fowl of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged thing will tell the word. So, some passages in Ecclesiastes require more unpacking than others. Fair to say, this one requires a bit more unpacking than others. Again, I have to plug Alter's translation of this book, of this text. This last line, even on your couch, revile not a king, and in your sleeping chambers, revile not a rich man, for the fowl of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged thing will tell the word. Beautiful translation by Alter, through and through. So, I'll offer some initial thoughts and exegesis, hopefully making some sense of these four verses. I assure you, there is not only is there deep wisdom here, but there is relevance here for our current moment. And then we'll look at chaos and order within the government, within our own household, and once again, the Christian response to that. So, I don't know, there may not be a way around it. Colette seems in this passage to be a fan of maintaining social order. I mean, like 16 and 17 is right there. So listen to this closely. Woe to you, land, whose king is a lackey, or king is a child, or even king is a servant, and your princes dine in the morning. And then the end, which I've already read to you a couple of times, referring to not reviling a king, not reviling a rich man. Is this simply Colette advocating for those who have power keeping their power and those who don't have power being relegated to the position they're in for their lives, maybe? Let me give my best argument that, in fact, Colette is not merely suggesting we maintain the status quo. So first, the aristocratic class is condemned at the very open of this passage. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child. So this is very similar to what you see just one chapter before, chapter 10, verses 5 through 7. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. One way to read this is, again, the same way that you would read the end of this chapter. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, or when your king is a lackey. One can read this, and scholars do discuss it. I mean, they recognize this may be Colette essentially affirming the status quo. I don't really think that's, and by the way, we all find ourselves disagreeing with things Colette says at one point or another. So it's not really a defense of his words. But I think really what we're seeing here is something more literary than that. I think what's being observed is that this is a corrupt world and things are upside down. They're often distorted. They're often twisted. Not twisted because the lackey should always be a lackey, but actually what is being communicated is the ideal ruler, the real ruler, is displaced by feasting princes and child kings. In chapter 4, verse 13, he says, "The wise youth is better than the old foolish king." So I don't think it's as simple as Colette merely affirming that those who have power should be able to keep it, and those who don't have power should never be able to gain any power. Really, what I think is being said here is more like what you would see in a Shakespearean tragedy. So when something goes wrong, or when something is out of place in the natural realm, think like Macbeth and the death of King Duncan or something, everything else goes wrong in the natural and supernatural realm as well. Night and day trade places, or the owl hunts the falcon. And I mean, in Shakespeare gets, you know, we could get into the horses cannibalizing each other. I mean, he gets into some really weird stuff. But I think it's actually something very similar that we see in this wisdom literature, which is when the natural order of things is twisted and distorted, and you have the wrong people leading, and you have the wrong people serving those leaders, the real rulers are displaced by drunken princes, for example, things are going to go very wrong. And I think what Colette is saying is, don't be surprised at all when you look at the world and everything is out of joint and out of place, and people who shouldn't be ruling are ruling. So Van Leeuwen calls this the world turned upside down topos. And I think that actually cuts most clearly to the heart of this particular wisdom teaching. Expect a world that is often turned upside down. In fact, we really should have, if we take this wisdom teaching seriously, we really should have the posture of being surprised when things in the world are making sense. Expect things to be out of place, out of order, chaotic, the wrong people leading, the wrong people in positions of service, when in fact they may be the people that should be leading. So this sets the stage for our discussion over chaos and order within the government, and over chaos and order within your own household. The first observation I have on this, and the only observation concerning chaos and order within the government, is this. Very straightforward, but I think it's worth keeping in mind. It takes many leaders to fail for a nation to fail. It takes many leaders to fail for a nation to fail. So Colette is certainly criticizing the king. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, or a lackey, or an underling, depending on what translation you like. But it goes on, and your princes feast in the morning. So it's not just the king who is bringing sorrow to this land. It's not just one person that can cause a nation to fail or to decline. If anything, this text indicates that it takes a failure of leadership through and through to bring sorrow to the land. And so I think there's tremendous wisdom in that as we think about chaos and order within our government. First, there's some immediate just takeaways here. First, it's not a waste of time or energy to evaluate who is in leadership and to assess their competence. So I'm sure that many of you have seen this general posture, which is because the systems in which we operate and live are complex, and assigning blame or understanding who is at fault for the various shortcomings of the systems that affect our lives, that's complex and very hard. And so I know that many, and myself at times included, there is a tendency to simply dismiss this and to perhaps paint with too broad a brush. But I actually think what we get in this text, and admittedly, it's not saying it explicitly, but I think it's here. I mean, look at verse 17. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time. For those who would say, well, he's just simply affirming, again, those who have power keeping the power. Look at the line, and your princes feast at the proper time. In other words, happy is the land who has leadership that doesn't, you know, have two cocktails before noon, right? And they're feasting at the proper time. They're knowing when to engage in austerity, and they know when to celebrate abundance. And they're doing this for strength and not for drunkenness. So he is uplifting the traits of what nobility really should be, not merely nobility. And what I see in this is Colette, admittedly offering it as this short axiomatic wisdom, bit of wisdom, but Colette is essentially saying that we should analyze, we should think about. It's not a waste of time to think about and to evaluate those who are in leadership, because great leadership leads to a happy land, and poor leadership leads to a land that is in mourning, or a land that is suffering. So this first initial takeaway that is, again, I think very practical, is that we should not see ourselves as above. We concern ourselves with spiritual matters. We're above exploring the political implications of our decisions or the ramifications of who we put in leadership. I don't think that that is a wise way to approach our lives. And I don't think it's a wise way to approach our role as citizens in a government. It's not a waste of time or energy to evaluate who is in leadership and to assess their competence, even though it's incredibly complex. And I think we can explore the complexity of the chaotic, the chaos we see and the order we see in various government systems without obsessing over it and turning it into a sport or a hobby or something that really actually demeans what's happening, which is that real decisions and laws and policies are shaping people's lives. And so I actually think it's an act of compassion and it requires a certain generosity of spirit to care enough about policy, for example, and to understand that it is, and to understand that policy is shaping the lived experiences of people, often people who are marginalized, who have really no voices of their own, so to speak, and I think the role of the Christ follower is to care about that and engage it in ways that we think are appropriate. And that is it. That's its own very complex conversation, and I understand that. But nonetheless, this passage is crystal clear about the consequences of having people in leadership that should not be there. One other practical observation under this first point really has to do with the posture of the wise Christ follower. And I think that the posture that is being articulated here is one that encourages us to avoid caricaturing politicians or political parties as entirely good or totally depraved. It's always been interesting when we get into a text in the Bible that has some kind of political overtones, and after maybe a discussion or in one of our conversations, I'm at a table or I'm talking to an individual, and there's this kind of implication that, like, yeah, I know the politician that you're talking about right now. I know who you're referring to. And I think, well, I mean, I'm not sure that you do. I mean, the reality is that it's very easy to aim at individual politicians that stand in opposition to our political values, our moral or ethical values, when in fact, I think the wiser posture is not looking at individual players, even though we should spend some time on that. I think the wiser posture, though, is examining the complex systems underneath those leaders, the systemic problems that have allowed various leaders of one party or another, of one kind or another, to assume authority. And that's such a value, I think, in the life of the Christian, that she isn't one who narrows her disdain or concern into a single figurehead. Rather, she understands that actually there are many systems in place. There are many leaders that have been put in place to allow for really corrupt or dangerous or immoral or unethical things to happen within our government. In other words, to allow for chaos within our government. And so, and this is as much something that I find to be maybe convicting as much as I would say this to anybody who is within our community. I would say this to myself. It is very tempting to identify individual players and assign blame. It may be wiser to devote energy to understanding complex systems and the ways to engage those systems and potentially remedy the problems that we find there. And I candidly think that one way to, because what I hear quite frequently, and this is something that I, it's a concern I share, like, where do we find the time, where do we find the resources to understand what political cause we should pour into, where we should put our energy, if we really are looking past loving and hating certain political players and really looking at how to move or impact systems, if we even can, by the way. And I'm well aware of that debate. So some of you are like already writing the text to me. You understand these systems are unchangeable. Yes, I understand that it's there are deep problems there. But how do we If we take for granted that maybe these systems can be impacted, that maybe at some level, at the level of policy, at the level of practice, we can do good, how do we navigate that? How do we have the time or resources? I don't really have an answer to that. I think we have to be narrow, and we have to be calculating in how we make impact. I have this. There's a great Zadie Smith quote from her novel On Beauty, Stop worrying about your identity and concern yourself with the people you care about, ideas that matter to you, beliefs you can stand by, tickets you can run on. Intelligent humans make those choices with their brain and hearts, and they make them alone. The world does not deliver meaning to you. You have to make it meaningful and decide what you want and need and must do. It's tough, unimaginably lonely and complicated. It's a tough and unimaginably lonely and complicated way to be in the world, but that's the deal. You have to live. You can't live by slogans, dead ideas, cliches, or national flags. Finding an identity is easy. It's the easy way out. She says much there, and in fact, maybe not even all of it totally applies to this part of the conversation, but the last line, and by the way, the whole book is worth your time. The last line, though, you have to live. You can't live by slogans, dead ideas, cliches or national flags. Finding an identity is easy. It's the easy way out. I think that the minute we jump into complex systems and we begin to look at one policy at a local level, you know, at the state level, one policy within our workplace that, if changed, could make people's lives better, we understand immediately how complex things get and how many stakeholders have cross purposes and interests. And I think that kind of work is the work that matters. And I think that focusing on the people you care about, when we should care about the people that are in the most need, the most marginalized, that focusing on how we can help those people may be a way to think about how we can move larger systems. And if we cannot move larger systems to, again, avoid that kind of fatalistic perspective, if we can't move larger systems, maybe we can at least be good actors in some ways within them, or be good actors by abstaining from our involvement in them at all. And again, that's its own dialogue. So the first point to recap from these four verses: it takes many leaders to fail for a nation to fail. And the wise person understands there's chaos and order within the government, and they respond to that chaos and that order in complex ways, because the problem is a complex one. The second part of the text has to do with chaos and order within our own households. And I have one observation that I want to bring home with this, and we'll discuss that for a bit before close. Let me read these verses again. Through sloth, this is verse 18, through sloth the roof sinks in, and through indolence the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money keeps everyone busy. That great phrase, money keeps everyone busy. So this is all about chaos and order within our own households. And it actually chooses to focus, Colette chooses to focus on work, obviously, and laziness, right? So slothfulness causes the things in your home to fall apart. Slothfulness causes the things in your life to fall apart. On the other hand, if you're working hard, you're going to be able to better take care of the things you're responsible for. And then he really cuts through that to make this very, very enigmatic observation about money. And that's going to be the focus, really, of what chaos and order looks like within a household. So here's the observation I have based on these verses: that we should take responsibility for why we are saying yes or no to money. We should take responsibility for why we are saying yes or no to money. So if you limit your acquisition of money, you necessarily limit your access to the things that money can buy. If you increase your acquisition of money, other things, both for good and for bad, will increase as well. So I love this text because it's such a tricky text, and I think it's because it's talking about such a delicate problem in our lived experience, which is basically that it's good to stay busy with enjoyment, and the money required to have pleasures is good to have. However, the very money that was so useful in keeping order in the household or acquiring pleasures on a dime in a moment can turn, and the pleasure that was good becomes this excessive blind enjoyment that Colette warns about throughout the book, particularly chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. So once we see these, I think he's actually presenting these two competing ideas. I mean, as he always does, he's presenting this tension between these two competing ideas at once. On the one hand, carpe diem. On the other hand, too much money, too much pleasure in a moment can turn. And suddenly the thing that is actually wise to have, which is enough, it's good to enjoy things. It's even arguably wise to enjoy things. This can turn in a moment into excess. And then suddenly becomes very destructive. And then you have this phrase that is really, I think, genius, at least in Alter's translation. And money keeps everyone busy. How this is so matter of fact. However great meals and delicious food is, however enjoyable drinks with friends can be, behind all of it is the fact that everyone is working to make enough money to spend on all of these things. Some of the things matter, some of the things matter less, but we know this, money keeps everyone busy, and it can be for the good, and in a second, it can be for the bad. And so in one moment, you're saying to yourself, actually, the work that I'm doing, the amount of energy I'm putting in to my career, my job, the hours I'm putting in, it's actually promoting order because it's allowing me to pay for the things I need, pay for the things I enjoy, and enjoy the day, to be generous to other people, and on and on. And in a second, and it's such a subtle shift, in a moment, suddenly those good things that were producing order now actually feel more like chaos, and not even feel more like chaos. In an empirical examination of them, it may be that you're acting in chaotic ways. You know, we can work a lot, and that work can be a source of chaos because it's not allowing us to have balance or groundedness in other parts of our lives, parts that matter arguably more. George MacDonald, who I was initially introduced to through a collection of like essentially his poetry and quotes from C.S. Lewis. MacDonald was a major influencer of Lewis, as many of you know. MacDonald said this, "Work is not always required. There is such a thing as sacred idleness." And that is something that actually many people, not only in our community, but elsewhere, really need to hear. There is such a thing as sacred idleness. And I hear, like, as you're like listening to this, wherever you are, as you're listening to this, you're like, actually, I've not been to work in 2 weeks or something like that. Yes, I understand that right now, it may be that idleness is not very hard to come by for some people. For many, there are different stories out there. But for those of you who would say, actually, idleness is the opportunity to be idle is quite available to me right now. Yeah, but MacDonald is talking about sacred idleness, which is to say that we understand that slowing, and we understand that not seeing ourselves merely as workers and consumers can be sacred, but that's not immediate. That's not our default position. So for the fact that you were home all day yesterday, let's say that you were, it doesn't really mean that you're engaging in the sacred. It's quite a lot of work to move from the paradigm of I am a worker and I am a consumer into the paradigm of actually there's room for idleness that is not only, we're not talking about the slothfulness that's represented in chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes, we're not talking about laziness. McDonald's quote is making a really brilliant observation that we can look at our day-to-day lives and see value in them and see each day as an opportunity to connect to the sacred, to connect to Christ, to connect to one another, and that is arguably a vocational act, and that we are more than the amount of work we can produce, and we are more than the goods that we consume. And so I think at the core of this brilliant and very open statement, and money keeps everyone busy, is a recognition that there's much good that comes from earning money and using money well, earning money and using money for pleasure and enjoyment. And depending on the individual that you're talking to, depending on, like, you know, kind of where you're at, what season you're at in life, all of us have fallen too far in one direction or another. And so we know that money keeps everyone busy. Can we earn money? Can we utilize money in a way that promotes order and not in a way that promotes more chaos? And so again, very, very tricky passage here, because it's not entirely clear what Ecclesiastes, what Colette is getting at and what Ecclesiastes is saying, even as you look at this one line in context of the rest of the book. But I have to spend a moment longer on this, because underneath all of this is this understanding that our society is organized in such a way that it is near impossible to have an ethical and right relationship with money. And I mean, that has to be, without spending lots of time on a topic like that, that would probably be better conducted in another way anyway, it's important to understand that, like, as followers of Jesus, that we are in this culture, and we're in a society where healthy relationships with money are virtually impossible. And so we see better and worse examples of this, right? I'm not saying you can't have, like, it's that you can't have any health in your relationship with money. I'm simply saying that it is very complex to think about money rightly in a society like ours. But to put it directly, the idea that you can buy a better life is perverse. And at minimum, this text, these few verses, provokes me to think about the implications of living in a society that is wealth obsessed and debt saturated. And to look like, to carry the ethos of Jesus in a society like this requires us to go back to some fundamental truths about money and how we utilize it, and to reevaluate that, to take a serious look at it anyway. I think that it's no surprise to me that Jesus talks about money as much as he does. It seems that money is a very useful indicator of the degree to which we allow various forms of chaos into our lives, into our lived experience. And I think that's one reason that we're reluctant to talk about money very much, or really to take seriously like where our money is going and what that might say about our what we value and our practices. And so it's sometimes hard to take a look at that. And some of you, and there are people within our community that I know are very, very good at taking a look at that. And so obviously this is not, I'm not trying to make categorical statements here. I'm simply saying that it's useful and maybe appropriate to begin there. Begin in the places that sometimes bring us the most anxiety or pain. And so that may be looking at the level of the household. This is looking at, you know, the budget. This is looking at what's coming in and are we working enough? Are we not working too much? And that's been something I've seen, an ongoing thing I've seen within our community. This strange thing that we promote this, addictive behavior as it pertains to work, and we call it a virtue, when actually it takes tremendous, and I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating, it takes tremendous courage to at once say no to money, say no to more money, and it also takes tremendous courage to be generous with the money you have. And so again, the McDonald quote, there is such a thing as sacred idleness. And it is true that sometimes we can mask the thing we're trying to avoid dealing with by focusing on earning. But that's at the household level. Again, there's this other layer, which is the societal level of our relationship to wealth and how we think about wealth. And I don't even exactly know where to begin there. I mean, there's some, I will recommend, I happened to listen to this podcast two weeks ago. I recommend, The Wright Show, where Robert Wright, interviewed, Richard Vague, who wrote a book called The Next Economic Disaster. And, he offered some very interesting ideas concerning how we think about wealth. And I think we have some responsibility to just begin to listen to expert voices and insightful voices. There, we wish there were more, but to begin to read the right people, to maybe hit the reset button on how we're thinking about wealth and money. All the better for us. I could also recommend, this is a book that I've not read, but she gave a very famous TED Talk some number of years ago, Michelle McGaugh, and she wrote this book, The No Spend Year, where for 1 year she spends no money. I'm sure there are caveats to that. And again, I've not read the book, so I find it useful to, I think it's built into the text. I think it's useful to identify these voices that are approaching money in fresh and different ways, because it may allow us to think about and approach money in fresh and different ways. Because again, as Coelette says, money keeps everyone busy. So we'll wrap up these final few verses and then some final observations on the Christian response to all of this kind of holistically. Coelette says, "Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter." So some of you might notice I'm alternating between the ESV and Alter's translation. Little time should be spent on verses 20 and 21, or I suppose just verse 20 there, because it's really just a quip at the end of this collection of wisdom teachings. Basically, even in your bedroom, don't say anything about the king or the very rich people, because you think you have privacy, but you do not. Someone is going to hear some bit of that gossip, and it's going to come back to hurt you. But of course, we're meant to read this as humor, because, I mean, he's writing these things down, right? So, hey, don't even whisper a thing against the king. You know, I'm going to put it in print, but you don't whisper a thing about the king. And so I think that quip is a good way to end the entire chapter. I want to offer a few final concluding observations for you to be in discussion over this week and to be meditating on this week. So what I want to say is that the reality is sometimes we will spend our entire lives in a land where the king is a child, and even some of the worst and most unjust features of our society pale in comparison to the brutalities that governments have perpetrated on their citizens throughout recorded history. Of course, again, that's not to say that we shouldn't engage in justice wherever we see it and in whatever ways we're able. But the fact is that in the length of one of our lives, we may see some years that are very good, and we may see many, many more that are very bad, and there's no really guarantee of any kind that we should expect things to simply work out. And why? Why? Because in some way we're special? I mean, that is naive, and it's foolish. So sometimes people are fortunate and they are happy because they are born into a land where the king is qualified. And tragically, more often it seems that the former is true. So how should the Christ follower live in response to this? How can we stand really to endure when there is so much uncertainty? We can make this about our current situation across America and then globally, but it doesn't have to be that. I mean, 1 year ago there were concerns that were keeping many of you up at night. This is what it is to live in an unpredictable world. But whether we are blessed to have many years in a land with a wonderful king, or whether we have the misfortune of many years in a land that is corrupt, peace is available to those who are with Christ. And it's my sincere prayer for each of you that you meditate on the peace that is already yours because Christ is King. If we have the good fortune of having wonderful leadership, or the misfortune of horrendous leadership, and all that is in between, it's my prayer that you enjoy, that you are grounded in, that deep at the heart of who you are is sincerely the peace of Jesus, this peace that allows you to, in spite of so many uncertainties within the household, as it were, and without, in spite of all of these uncertainties, this incredible peace that allows you to rest well at night. I know that for many people who love Christ and love others, they will also say that that kind of peace, it seems elusive and it seems impossible. So let me give you a few words on that. First, live for Christ. By living for Him, we begin to partake in His divine nature, and we begin to see things the way He sees them. Dave Eggers, this has to be the best book Eggers has ever written, and maybe is certainly his most famous, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. This quote, so good, from that text: "Nothing can be preserved. It's all on the way out. From the second it appears, and whatever you have always has one eye on the exit, and so screw it. As hideous and uncouth as it is, we have to give it all away. Our bodies, our secrets, our money, everything we know, all must be given away every day, because to be human means, one, to be good, two, to save nothing. Live for Christ." And as you begin to do this, it's not magic, but as you begin to do this, as you take on the mind of Christ and see things the way Jesus lived them, of course, this is done through the Spirit of God in you. As you begin to do that, to be good and to save nothing, what by comparison will seem like a supernatural peace will slowly permeate your life. First, live for Christ. Second, trust in Christ. This is from Tim Keller, who I think so often strikes at so many countercultural insights about what it is to be a Christian. Trust in Christ. Keller says, "Accept what He sends into your life, whether you understand it or not. Accept what He sends into your life, whether you understand it or not." Next, I would say, abide in Christ. Hear Christ. I think it's very unfortunate that so much of evangelical Christianity has reduced God to an emotion, a fleeting thought that whispers in your ear, a feeling during a moment of service. One of the reasons so many people are struggling through this season when we're not able to gather together is that their experience, their hearing Christ, their abiding in Christ has been reduced to a single experience in a week, when in fact it permeates all of our experience. Please hear this. God communicates through the seasons He presents to us by forming us through them. This is all about the sovereignty of God. Trust this process. Allow God to take you in unexpected directions as He guides us through the arc of the seasons of our lives. We talked about this way back in Ecclesiastes when we looked at the catalog of chapter 3. Don't insist the primary way to experience God is to hear Him speaking. Do you understand the strange and unusual pressure that puts on you, frankly, as a follower of Jesus? Is it possible, please hear this, is it possible that God isn't showing you anything that is merely communicated through language, but in fact, maybe through the experiences that he is putting before you, that He is uncovering in you who He has always made you to be, through the instrument of joyous seasons and through the instrument of hard seasons in your life? That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about abiding in Christ and hearing Him. I'm not talking about a moment. I'm talking about understanding that you've been placed in a season, and through that, God is communicating. Perhaps it need not be said, but the scriptures are really the map, the guide that allows us to, it's like a tuning mechanism that allows us to hear God speaking in other places in our lived experience. By understanding the rhythms and sounds of the scriptures, we begin to hear those same rhythms and experience those sounds elsewhere. And so, of course, the scriptures, and of course, prayer, and of course, community. But understand that God communicates through the very season that you're in. And it may not be a specific word. It may just be that he's uncovering in you who you are. And you should celebrate that. It brings a sense of peace as opposed to a sense of anxiety. Finally, receive from Christ. Receive from Christ. Proverbs 10:22 says, "The Lord's blessing is what makes one rich, and straining adds nothing to it." We know that money keeps everyone busy, but we also believe that the Lord's blessing is what makes one rich, and straining adds nothing to it at all. Blessings, we love you. And we look forward to the time we can come back together and enjoy conversation with one another. And we'll talk again next week.